Welcome to the Climate of Change podcast, and on today's episode, I speak with Kim Reid about her work researching atmospheric rivers and precipitation, as well as thinking about climate anxiety and equity and diversity in the earth sciences. This is followed by some of the main climate news headlines from March 2024, and then the reflection for today will take us through a visualization of what the earth and human civilization could look like if we change our society to one that is based on principles of sustainability and environmentally friendly practices. So I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And with that, let's get on to the interview. Hi, Kim. Thank you so much for joining us on the interview today. To start off, I wonder if you could tell us about yourself, who you are, and where you're from.
So I'm Kim. I'm 28, and I'm from Melbourne, Australia. I did my Bachelor of Science and a major in climate and weather at Melbourne University, followed by a master's and PhD also at Melbourne. And now I work at Monash University as a postdoc in the Centre of Excellence for Climate Extremes.
And was there anything that inspired you or encouraged you to go into this field of work?
Really had no idea what I wanted to do as a kid. I kind of jumped around. I wanted to be a chef at one point, then a lawyer, then a doctor, as you do. I guess ultimately I wanted to be helpful to society and help improve society, but I wasn't really a people person, so I didn't want to be a doctor or anything like that. And then I was always good at maths and science as a kid. And I think growing up, I grew up during the millennium drought, so the early 2000s. So the relevance of weather and climate on society was really obvious from a young age. And I remember using buckets from the washing machine to water the garden and stuff like that. I think in year 10, we did a unit on climate change and we watched An Inconvenient Truth. And I think I was just shocked at how clear the science was, but how lacking in political will and government action, I guess, kind of inspired me to focus on climate issues. And then in my undergrad, I did math, I did science, and was really interested in natural disasters. So I did a few subjects on how we can make our cities more resilient and improve warnings for natural disasters. So that sort of led me down the extreme weather path. And then at the end of my bachelor's, I applied for a whole bunch of graduate jobs with government and got rejected from everything, as happens. So I wasn't intending to do postgrad study, but I did it. I signed up as a bit of a filler until I could apply again, but I ended up really enjoying the research side of it to my own surprise. So if there's anyone listening at that career stage and you get rejected, it's okay. It's not the end of the world.
And what are you currently researching and working on?
Yeah, so I'm employed by the Centre of Excellence for Climate Extremes. So it's all about understanding how the extreme aspects of our climate, particularly extreme weather, affects Australia. And so I did my PhD on a phenomenon called atmospheric rivers, which are basically these rivers in the sky, huge narrow streams of water vapor transport that are about 2,000 kilometres long. And they're called rivers because they transport about the same amount of water as, say, the Amazon River. There's been a lot of work on these systems in the Northern Hemisphere, in the US in particular. On the west coast of the US quite recently, they've copped a few, but not a lot in Australia. So my PhD was really trying to understand these phenomenon in Australia. So my work now is, again, looking at rainfall, looking at moisture transport, how much water vapor moves over the east coast of Australia and how that might change in the future with climate change. The reason for that is a lot of the extreme rainfall events in 2021 and 2022 were associated with this really high amount of water vapor. We want to know how that might change in the future and what we need to prepare for.
And is there anything from your research that has surprised you or that you'd like to highlight?
One of the main things was mostly that we do get atmospheric rivers here in Australia, and we've calculated they contribute about 30% of the extreme rainfall to the Murray-Darling Basin. So the Murray-Darling Basin is sort of the main agricultural, or one of the main agricultural regions in Australia, and just a vital ecosystem for eastern Australia. So rainfall is kind of split into, there's two key components. There's what we call the thermodynamics, which is basically the moisture, and the dynamics, so where the rainfall falls, the sort of weather systems like a cold front or a low pressure system that causes the rain. And we have a pretty good idea about the thermodynamics. So we know that as the atmosphere warms, it can hold more water, but we have less confidence in our understanding of the dynamics, where that water will eventually fall. And so we know that we'll likely see more intense atmospheric rivers, but exactly where they will occur is the question that we're trying to figure out. And so basically the climate models we have, they're very good, but they're quite coarse. So they kind of look at the world through 100 kilometer by 100 kilometer grids. And we really need higher resolution, more pixels to properly understand the dynamics of these weather systems in the future. So there's a lot of work going into looking at more powerful models to try and understand rainfall in particular all over the globe.
In terms of the extreme fluctuations that we are seeing between droughts and floods, I know that not all river systems or dams have necessarily been designed to withstand such extreme flood events. What can we do to manage those fluctuations in terms of practical or policy solutions?
So there's been quite a few programs where they're trying to implement this thing called forecast-informed reservoir operations, where they're using the weather forecast up to a few weeks ahead to work out whether they need to release a bit of water if they're expecting extreme rainfall. So I think, yes, planning for both, which is obviously very hard, planning for both drought and flood, but we need to realize that we experience both extremes and we can't just plan for one.
And so what are some mitigation strategies for dealing with not just floods, but other extreme weather events such as heat waves?
We've spent the last few decades putting a whole bunch of concrete everywhere, which isn't great for heat waves. It's not great for flooding. And I think just adding more green spaces and rewilding the landscape is a great natural defense for a lot of extreme weather. Green spaces in particular, it's a relatively cheap way of protecting ourselves. On the coast, mangroves, you see these really cool videos of just the effect of mangroves, say during a tropical cyclone, having the mangroves there can stop the storm or reduce the storm surge by a massive amount. And just thinking about where we build, I realize it's hard when we have a cost of living and housing crisis to compete with as well. And building on floodplains is cheaper, but ultimately it'll be more expensive. Just thinking about where we build and how we build. And there's so many simple solutions. For example, I know in Canberra, I think they had a program where if you paint your roof white, you can get some rebate because white reflects light. And so it can help cool your house. And so there are all these relatively simple creative measures that everyday people can employ to help protect themselves.
There's been a lot of reporting this year around us exceeding 1.5 degrees Celsius for a full 12-month period for the first time. What's your view, personal or professional, on where we are with the 1.5 degree metric?
So we've passed 1.5 temporarily, but not by the IPCC definition, which requires a sort of longer term passing of 1.5. But I think the general view among climate scientists is that meeting the Paris Agreement is gone. We're definitely going to cross 1.5. The main question is whether we can then bring it. So there's this idea of overshoot where we might go past 1.5 for a few years, but if we can draw down some carbon out of the atmosphere, we can hopefully bring it back to below 1.5. The main goal with all of these is just to every fraction of warming is going to cause impacts that we don't want. And so if we can reduce it by anything, that's ideal. Ideally, let's keep it below 2. I think at 2, we say bye-bye to the Great Barrier Reef, which I think is pretty devastating.
And to me, hearing something like we lose the Great Barrier Reef at 2 degrees of warming, it's very anxiety provoking for me. And I know a lot of people feel anxious about climate change. Do you yourself feel climate anxiety?
Yeah, it's an interesting topic. I've felt most of my time, because I view climate change through such a scientific lens, it's my job. You almost get a little bit numb to it, except last year when it was, I think it was in June or May, and there was, I think we breached 1.5, or there was a report saying we were about to breach 1.5, and I was doing a lot of media about that. And I remember being on an interview, it has quite a big audience, and just being asked about, you know, how screwed are we? And it was quite daunting to be the one telling millions of people, actually, it's not looking great unless we somehow turn this ship around. And I think that was the first experience of
for climate anxiety.
And is there anything you do or would advise others to do in order to deal with their anxiety around climate change?
There is a lot of focus on individual actions. And on one hand, it's nice to be able to do something because it can be very frustrating watching governments go through yet another COP and see emissions still rising. So it is empowering to feel like we're making a difference. But the problem, I think, is that something like 100 companies are responsible for 70% of emissions. And so, I mean, riding your bike more is a great thing to do. There's a lot of health benefits. It does reduce emissions, but ultimately, in order to stop climate change, we need this larger scale change. And so the most impactful thing you can really do is vote and pressure governments to stop allowing all these emissions. I guess the main thing that I find useful is to turn it into action. Wallowing in despair doesn't really help anyone. So turning it into action, if you're feeling anxious, use that anxiety to write to your MP or, you know, get your friends or family to vote and to vote for a party that's not going to be allowing fossil fuel companies to keep going. I guess turning that anxiety into action is the number one thing. And if you have to switch off for a couple of days, like, you're allowed to do that.
I'm also curious in terms of equity and climate change, what your opinions are around where the impacts are going to be and how much support exists for scientists in countries that aren't as economically wealthy as much as a country such as Australia.
So one thing that's quite notable about climate impacts is if you look at the IPCC reports, and they often show these graphs where they'll have future temperature changes and they'll have little hexagons that represent the world and it'll say what's the projected change and how confident are we for temperature or rainfall. And you'll notice that there's a lot of confidence for Europe, North America, a little bit for Australia and New Zealand. And then it's pretty much grey for Africa, for South America, parts of Asia. And the reason for that is that we just don't have enough studies in those locations. And that, I guess, the accessibility of doing science really depends a lot on where you're born. And I'm obviously incredibly privileged to be born in Australia. But I have colleagues where if English is not your first language, scientific journals will make you get an English-speaking colleague to read it before they'll let you publish. There's all these ridiculous hurdles to doing science if you're not born in Australia or America or Europe that I think is really important for understanding how the planet will change in a warming climate. And so there was a climate conference in Rwanda last year where they discussed all this. And I didn't go, but my supervisor did, so I've heard a lot of stories secondhand. But there's these discussions about how we can get places in Africa to be able to have run their own climate models because it requires so many resources in terms of computing power, people power, and it's important for Africa to be prepared for the future climate. They need to be able to run their own analyses. And so there's quite a lot of discussion about how we can do that, how we can make research more equitable. But I guess I wanted to use this platform to highlight that although there's a lot of effort going into diversity and equity, there's still a long way to go, especially in terms of making science accessible for the global south and for people who don't have English as their first language. And the kind of silly barriers that could be overcome with, you know, hiring a copy editor for a journal. Again, simple solutions that you don't need these massive barriers that do exist. I think the other issue that I've noticed is just where we hold events. So there are some countries where women or LGBTI people are still not accepted or treated as second-class citizens. And I think when we hold conferences or COP events in these countries, you basically make it hard for more than half the population to attend. And so thinking about where we hold conferences so that everyone attending can go and they as an individual aren't considered illegal in the country is something to think about.
These are all really good points, and I hope we can all do better in not only creating awareness around these issues, but also encouraging all of society to do better for the places and for the people who don't have as much support as they need to address the challenges of climate change. And to you, Kim, I would like to say thank you so much for taking part in the interview and good luck with everything in the future.
Thank you for having me and thank you for making this podcast.
Climate change made news headlines during March 2024 for a number of different reasons, including for impacts and observations, where rising temperatures were noted, with records being shattered across the Northern Hemisphere, with February 2024 being the ninth consecutive month on record where temperatures have been the highest recorded. Earth's rotation was also being influenced by melting polar ice, which will affect timekeeping. There are disruptions to ocean patterns, including with studies revealing how ocean atmosphere interactions can increase jet stream variability and how aerosols from Asia are influencing ocean circulation. Ocean warming is threatening seagrass meadows, and model projections are warning of significant summer rainfall decline in southern Europe by 2100 if emissions keep rising. A winner and loser scenario emerges as plants migrate uphill due to warming, and some tropical birds seem more tolerant of heat stress than expected. Microbial food webs in peatlands are entirely changing, while invasive plant species are persisting in seed banks for centuries before rapid spread. Alarming signs relating to tipping points include accelerated Greenland glacier melting and a globally shifted freshwater cycle. Polynyas in Antarctica are also dramatically expanding. On the monitoring and measurement front, an outdoor days metric has been developed, which integrates temperature, humidity, and human comfort for heat risk assessment. Improved storm prediction is being achieved with satellite data simulation aiding in severe storm prediction, and high-resolution penguin tracking is helping to understand population trends. A novel method for tracking icebergs uses GPS-tracked icebergs to study ocean circulation. On the solutions and adaptation front, researchers have calculated updated carbon emission budgets for 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius Paris Agreement targets. Meanwhile, researchers have mapped areas to expand solar energy while minimizing impacts on shifting species ranges. And coupling green hydrogen production with cryptocurrency mining could promote renewable energy. Shifting diets could boost the feasibility of limiting warming. And self-heating concrete and cooling pavements are being explored to reduce heat exposure in urban environments. Fire suppression might exacerbate future wildfires. And vehicle emission policies have been noted as potentially improving children's health. There are also other headlines relating to droughts and soil desiccation, which may amplify carbon emissions. And combining climate action with deregulation or social justice policies could face backlash in the future. Virtual reality has been tested as a tool for inspiring action to help visualize worst-case scenarios. Environmental protection agencies of various governments have announced new emission standards. Over 30 nations have pledged to boost nuclear energy. Meanwhile, Germany has seen a sharp decline in emissions due to renewable energy. Underwater speakers are being used to restore coral reefs. Researchers have studied impacts on dog sledding businesses. Rising temperatures could further increase food prices, especially in Africa and South America. And the US has invested in battery storage combined with wind and solar projects. Europe is aiming for ambitious nature protection and climate plans. European Parliament has approved a nature restoration law despite farm protests. Leaders in Africa are pushing for better control on mineral demands for a clean energy transition. Leading Islamic scholars have urged a swift transition away from fossil fuels. Enhanced weathering techniques could both remove CO2 and boost crop yields. Apes across Africa are increasingly exposed to climate change impacts. And Europe's summer wet bulb temperature has seen a remarkable rise, indicating increased heat stress danger. Additional news headlines for March 2024 included that China has set modest goals for reducing energy intensity. An unprecedented snowfall and rain event has killed several people in Pakistan. The world is bracing for a potential fourth global coral bleaching event. A New Zealand tribe member has won the right to sue corporate polluters over climate change. Climate change could boost lizard populations in certain areas. The UK may struggle to meet its climate finance commitment. India's solar and wind deployment is projected to grow but might miss its target. The US has announced funding for renewable projects in rural and Native American areas. Headlines relating to key trends and controversy surrounding coal power for this month include from the International Energy Agency that reported a rapid decline in coal power used by industrialized nations, and renewable energy sources like wind and solar are becoming cheaper than coal in regions such as the Asia Pacific. India and China are driving the increase in global coal power and emissions, and financing coal projects is becoming challenging for private utilities even in countries like India. Meanwhile, Pakistan faces economic strain due to high costs of imported coal. There are also concerns around environmental standards and underreporting of emissions. This includes in Indonesia, where underreporting of coal mine methane emissions has underscored the underestimated environmental impact. the US and Canada are finally addressing water pollution concerns from Canadian coal mines. First Nations groups in Canada have raised concerns about transboundary impacts of coal mining. Meanwhile, in South Africa, the future of coal mining and Eskom, the national power utility, are key themes in South Africa's upcoming election. Eskom's aging coal plants are blamed for the country's load shedding crisis. On the legal battle and closure front, a Polish court decision could impact the expansion of a lignite mine due to cross-border environmental concerns. A court in Bulgaria has cancelled a permit for a lignite power plant project. On the steel industry and decarbonisation front, a new report suggests China could reduce steel sector emissions by optimising electric arc furnace use. The International Energy Agency has reported record high methane emissions from coal mines. And the US Department of Energy plans to invest in steel plant redevelopment with new electric arc furnaces. And India's Supreme Court has ordered political parties to disclose donor information, including those from coal companies. Meanwhile, on the gas front, there are several notable headlines, including relating to stalled projects and financing issues, such as contract negotiations for a major LNG project in Tanzania have stalled, Qatar's production capacity increase casts doubt on the viability of struggling projects, and financing for gas projects in Papua New Guinea and Mozambique are facing difficulties. The World Bank sees a path for emerging European and Central Asian countries to transition away from coal to clean energy instead of relying on gas. Meanwhile, traditional landowners in Australia have challenged Santos's gas drilling plans to their land due to overlooked climate change considerations. And the EU's excessive gas infrastructure plans raise concerns about commitment to climate goals. A new study has also revealed the significant methane emissions problem in Texas and New Mexico's oil and gas fields. The US, meanwhile, is attempting to influence Tanzania's LNG contract negotiations in favour of oil and gas giants. And Europe's reliance on Caspian gas from Azerbaijan raises questions about climate commitment. Investor pressure on oil and gas companies in Australia and Denmark is increasing due to climate inaction. A study by Global Witness highlights the potential future heat deaths caused by the top oil and gas companies' emissions, urging government intervention. The US Export-Import Bank supports new gas extraction in Bahrain despite climate concerns. LNG trading companies hold substantial cash reserves due to recent market conditions, and deregulation of gas markets in Europe may be contributing to inflationary pressures. In this week's reflection, we consider different aspects of the planet and human civilization, including energy, urban environments, transportation, agriculture, waste, the ocean, conservation, lifestyle, education, and global cooperation. We consider what each of these topics might be like in an idealized version of the future, where humanity has revolutionized its behavior and practices and addressed our damage and destruction of the environment. In reflecting on an ideal future, we express our hopes and optimism for a future where humanity and the planet are in balance and the health and prosperity of all life is prioritized. Energy. In an idealized future, humanity's energy needs are met entirely through renewable sources. Solar panels, wind turbines, hydroelectric dams, and geothermal plants dot the landscape and cityscapes, harnessing the Earth's natural power. Homes and buildings are not just consumers of energy, but also producers. Equipped with solar roofs and innovative technologies that convert kinetic energy from human activities into electricity, energy storage systems are highly efficient, ensuring that the fluctuations in renewable energy production are smoothed out, providing a constant and reliable power supply. The transition to renewable energy has drastically reduced carbon emissions, contributing to a significant reversal of climate change trends. Urban environments. Future urban environments are designed with sustainability and human well-being at their core. Cities are filled with green spaces, vertical gardens, and rooftop farms, reducing the urban heat island effect and improving air quality. Buildings are constructed using eco-friendly materials and designed to be energy efficient, minimizing their environmental footprint. Rainwater harvesting and grey water recycling systems are standard, promoting water conservation. Urban planning prioritizes community spaces, encouraging social interaction and a connection to nature, fostering a sense of belonging and well-being amongst residents. Transportation. Transportation in the future is revolutionized to be sustainable and efficient. Electric vehicles dominate the roads, charged by renewable energy and supported by a widespread infrastructure of charging stations.
public transportation systems are expanded and improved, offering convenient, affordable, and eco-friendly alternatives to personal vehicle use. Cities are designed to be walkable and bike-friendly, with extensive networks of cycling lanes and pedestrian paths. High-speed rail and hyperloop systems connect cities, reducing the need for short-haul air travel, further lowering the transportation sector's environmental impact. Economy and finance. The future economy is built on the principles of sustainability and circularity. Economic success is measured not just by GDP, but by indicators of environmental health and social well-being. Businesses operate within a circular economy framework where products are designed for durability, repairability, and recyclability, minimizing waste. Financial institutions invest heavily in green technologies and sustainable initiatives, driving innovation and supporting the transition to a sustainable economy. Consumer behavior shifts towards valuing quality and sustainability over quantity, supporting businesses that prioritize environmental and social responsibility. Agriculture. Agricultural practices in the future are sustainable and in harmony with nature. Regenerative farming techniques that improve soil health, water efficiency, and biodiversity are the norm. Precision agriculture powered by technology optimizes resource use, ensuring that crops receive exactly what they need, minimizing waste. Integrated pest management and polycultures reduce the need for chemical inputs, protecting ecosystems. Urban agriculture, including vertical farms and community gardens, are widespread, bringing food production closer to consumers, reducing food miles, and strengthening local food systems. Waste. In an idealized future, humanity has mastered the art of waste management, transforming what was once considered waste into valuable resources. The concept of waste has become obsolete, as societies worldwide have adopted zero-waste lifestyles and circular economies. Products are designed for durability, repairability, and recyclability from the outset, ensuring that they never end up as waste. Composting of organic materials is universal, returning nutrients to the soil and reducing the need for synthetic fertilizers. Advanced recycling technologies efficiently reclaim materials, ensuring that plastics, metals, and other resources are continuously reused. Localized waste processing centers support communities, turning waste streams into energy, new products, and raw materials. This systemic approach to waste not only conserves resources, but also significantly reduces environmental pollution, contributing to a healthier planet. The ocean. In this envisioned future, the oceans are vibrant and teeming with life, having benefited from comprehensive conservation efforts and sustainable practices. Overfishing is a thing of the past, replaced by carefully managed fisheries that ensure marine populations thrive. Marine protected areas have expanded significantly, providing safe havens for biodiversity and allowing ecosystems to recover and flourish. Coral reef restoration projects, coupled with a reduction in water pollution, have revived these critical habitats, supporting a diverse range of species. Plastics no longer pollute the waters thanks to global initiatives to eliminate single-use plastics and clean up existing marine litter. Sustainable aquaculture practices meet human needs for seafood without compromising the health of marine ecosystems. The oceans, once threatened, are now a source of inspiration and sustenance, playing a central role in the global climate system and human well-being. Eco-friendly materials. In the future, eco-friendly materials have become the cornerstone of manufacturing and construction, significantly reducing the environmental footprint of human activities. Biodegradable plastics derived from plant materials have replaced petroleum-based plastics, eliminating the issue of plastic pollution. The construction industry relies on sustainable materials like bamboo, recycled steel, and hempcrete, which offer durability and minimal environmental impact. Clothing and textiles are made from organic, sustainably sourced fibers, and the fashion industry operates on a closed-loop system where materials are continually reused. Packaging is minimal, biodegradable, or reusable, drastically reducing waste. This shift to eco-friendly materials has not only reduced pollution and resource depletion, but has also sparked innovation, leading to the development of new materials that harmonize with nature. Biodiversity conservation. In this ideal future, biodiversity conservation is a global priority, with efforts focused on preserving and restoring the natural habitats that support life on Earth. Extensive networks of protected areas and wildlife corridors ensure that diverse species can thrive and migrate freely. Ecosystems such as rainforests, wetlands, and grasslands are carefully managed and restored, providing essential services like carbon sequestration, water filtration, and soil fertility. Indigenous knowledge and practices play a crucial role in conservation efforts, recognized for their deep understanding of ecological balance. Urban planning incorporates green spaces and native plantings, supporting urban biodiversity and connecting city dwellers with nature. Education and awareness programs emphasize the intrinsic value of biodiversity, fostering a deep connection between humans and the natural world. Through these concerted efforts, the decline in species and habitats has been halted and reversed, ensuring a rich and resilient natural world for future generations. Lifestyle and consumption. In an ideal future, sustainable living is the norm, with individuals and communities worldwide adopting lifestyles that harmonize with the environment. The culture of fast consumption has been replaced by mindfulness and intentionality, where quality, sustainability, and ethical production are valued over quantity and disposability. People choose products that are durable, repairable, and have minimal environmental footprints, supporting a shift towards a circular economy. Minimalist living, focusing on the essentials and finding joy in simplicity and experiences rather than material possessions, has gained popularity. The concept of sharing economies has expanded, with communities sharing resources like tools, vehicles, and spaces, reducing the need for individual ownership and waste. Food choices have shifted towards plant-based diets, locally sourced, and seasonal produce, significantly reducing the carbon footprint associated with food production and transportation. This sustainable approach to lifestyle and consumption has not only lessened the strain on the planet's resources, but has also fostered a sense of community, well-being, and connection to the earth. Education. Education in this ideal future is the foundation for a sustainable society. Curriculums from early childhood through to higher education are infused with principles of environmental stewardship, social equity, and global citizenship. Schools serve as models of sustainability, incorporating renewable energy, green building designs, and gardens that provide hands-on learning experiences. Students learn not just through textbooks, but through engagement with the natural world and community projects, developing a deep understanding of the interconnectedness of all life. Critical thinking, creativity, and problem solving are emphasized, equipping students to address the challenges of sustainability. Education extends beyond formal institutions, with lifelong learning opportunities available to all, fostering a culture of continuous improvement and innovation for sustainability. This comprehensive approach to education cultivates a generation of informed, empowered individuals committed to making positive environmental and societal contributions. Global cooperation. In this envisioned future, global cooperation is the cornerstone of sustainability efforts. Nations have transcended political and economic differences, uniting in the face of environmental challenges. International agreements on climate action, biodiversity conservation, and sustainable development are not only ambitious but also equitable and enforceable. Technology and knowledge transfer between countries facilitate the adoption of sustainable practices worldwide, ensuring that no nation is left behind in the transition to a sustainable future. Multinational corporations operate responsibly, with accountability mechanisms in place to ensure their contributions to sustainability. Collaborative research and innovation efforts address global environmental issues, leading to breakthroughs that benefit all of humanity. This spirit of global cooperation fosters a sense of shared destiny and mutual responsibility, driving collective action towards a sustainable and prosperous future for the planet.